Crime Victims Criminal Records Division will come to order. Chair recognizes the quorum is present. Can I have a motion for the minutes of January 30th. I know Representative Kath thoroughly reviewed the minutes. So Representative Kath moves the minutes of January 30th. Are there any revisions? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
We have the minutes of February 16th, and Representative Hillstrom reviewed those, so she'll move those. If there's no revisions, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Both motions pass. First bill up this morning, we have Representative Ward. Are you prepared to proceed? And the motion, I believe, is that Representative Ward file 116 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Division. Let's see. Representative Perry, would you make that motion? I guess the chair can make it. So the motion is made by Representative Tamar. Then Representative Ward, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Today is one of those special days that you have an opportunity to make a real positive difference in the lives of all of our children in the state of Minnesota. Last session, legislation was passed which addressed safety issues surrounding Type 3 school vehicles and drivers. It required drivers to comply with a number of requirements, which actually came from a Office of Legislative Auditor report investigation, including in part of those requirements was a physical and drug test. The previous authors of the bill, Representative Bigham and Senator Olsen, intended to exempt school employees who are temporary or incidental Type 3 drivers from the physical and drug testing requirements through the language in the previous bill referring to, quote, normal duties. However, the term normal duties was interpreted by the Department of Public Safety differently than the legislative intent of the authors. Department of Public Safety's interpretation requires school districts to have anyone who may possibly drive a Type 3 vehicle meet these requirements, even though as regular school district employees, many of the requirements had already been met by regular employment within the school districts. This placed significant financial hardships on many school districts in the form of unfunded mandates, which caused them to look at maybe even continuing a lot of extra and co-curricular activities for our students in the state of Minnesota. House File 116 attempts to fix this problem while still protecting the safety of our children. It will bring the law back to its original legislative intent by requiring anyone who was employed for the sole purpose of driving a Type 3 vehicle must meet all of these requirements. Mr. Chair, I could talk about the changes in the bill from the previous bill, House File 116, but I would like to move to my testifiers. I have three testifiers today. Mr. Chair, Allison Porter, Jody Burr, and Kirk Schneider to testify on the bill.
Go ahead, Representative Ward. Move to your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to first introduce Allison Porter, and she will tell you how this bill has directly impacted her and her schools and students.
Ms. Porter.
Yes, Mr. Chair and member of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify today on this bill. I think it's a very important bill, and I think it's and I appreciate that the Representative Ward is part of authoring this bill and bringing it forward. I'm from Minnesota North Star Academy, and this is my third year at Minnesota North Star Academy. I want to talk with you about how the Type 3 driving requirements have impacted me and the other students at North Star. We have only deaf students at our school. In the past, we had cooking and transition classes, and our teachers could drive us to the grocery store or wherever we needed to go, but now they can't. Now, they also can't use the vans to drive us to games in other states, so that our team can play with other deaf teams. Now we have to rent a bus to drive us to our games, for field trips, for transition classes, or other school events. But now we can't because there are new driving requirements. And actually, I should tell you, I feel more safe with our deaf drivers, our deaf faculty driving, because if there was something that happened, I would be able to communicate. And other deaf students have said that that's true for them too. Now we can't do many of these things because of the new driving requirements. So we have no class field trips because our teachers are deaf. My school's gym also doesn't have a full court. It's only half a court. So we need to go, for example, to other schools or the YMCA to practice. And our teachers used to be able to drive us there. Our coaches, who are deaf, used to be able to drive. But now we have to practice only in the small gym, and that's not that good for us. And it's very hard for the students, the coaches, the teachers, the parents. And this has become very expensive for my school. I hope that you will consider changing the Type 3 driving requirements so that our coaches and teachers can drive us and we can have class field trips again and go to practice at the YMCA again. Thank you again for your time and for listening to my testimony today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Porter. Representative Ward, do you have another testifier?
Yes, I do. Mr. Chair, Jody Burr, please, and Kirk Schneiderlin.
Mr. Schneiderman and Ms. Burr, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Schneiderman. I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I just want to begin by thanking Representative Ward for taking this on and fixing this for school districts. It obviously had a number of unintended consequences, as we saw from the first testifier today. And I believe the language in front of you today fixes those unintended consequences for school districts. And we had a number, I mean, this is one of those small bills that our association spent an enormous amount of time on with our members, trying to clarify what this meant after last session. And we believe, after a number of meetings with the interested parties, that we've reached an agreement on what language is going to be acceptable to school districts that will work for us. And so we support the bill as it is, that yes, there will be some additional training for our employees, but we believe that that's important for the safety of our students. And it fixes the pieces that we thought were excessively, not excessively, but they were costly for school districts in terms of the physical examination and drug testing. And so this clarifies that those teachers who are coaches of the debate team or golf team or whatever it is, who drive the Type 3 bus, which is your station wagon, suburban, or van, who drive that maybe two or three times, would not be required to undergo those pieces. And so we think that this is a positive step, and we're certainly going to support this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Burr?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Boer. I'm a new lobbyist with Education Minnesota, and thank you for having me here. I want to start by also thanking Representative Ward for his work on this bill and others that have worked on it long before I got here. We strongly support this bill as well, and as Kirk mentioned, in addition to coaches, there are other people who have been impacted by the unintended consequences. For example, if there's a child at a school and they become sick and the parents, for a number of reasons, cannot get to the school to pick up their child, it may be a support person who has in the past helped get that child home. And so we believe that it's not reasonable for other people to have to go through the requirements. We believe that was unintended. And so I just want to close by saying that we do strongly support the bill and, again, thank Representative Ward. And we think this is also a positive step and will fix the problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Ward. And Representative Ward, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair, but I have a large number of support groups, and I can read those if you prefer. Otherwise, I'll just stand for questions.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we have you stand for questions, but members, I would like the questions to be limited to the criminal records provisions of this bill to just make sure it's that's the reason why this division has it. So are there questions from committee members on those portions? Not seeing any. Representative Paymar, you know, we could hear the list, Representative Ward, but moving on, it doesn't strike me as being controversial, at least for the portions that we have it for. So I'll just ask Representative Paymar to renew his motion that the House File 116 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Representative Hillstrom's Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And Representative Paymar, with your permission, if it's all right, I'd like to bump Representative Kalin's House File 551 to the next one on the agenda. Representative Kalin, are you prepared to proceed? There he is.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and members, my bill is House File 551, the Safe Neighborhoods Act, and with me today is Bill Schlumblum, Deputy Chief of the Chisago Lakes Area Police Department. And so if, Mr. Chair, you might be able to move my bill, and then I do have an author's amendment as well.
Yes, the Chair would move Representative Kalin's House File 551. And I don't think I have a copy of your. Well, maybe I do have a copy of yours. Would you please explain, Representative Kalin, what your office amendment does? But first, let's go ahead and well, the bill's been moved. So go ahead and explain your author's amendment, Representative Kalin.
Happily, Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment is the result of actually the bill and the amendments are the result of conversations with not only the affected community members in the. Response to a sex offender situation that's arisen in Chisago City that WC Schlumblum and I will explain in a second, but also working closely with Department of Corrections and Department of Public Safety staff, as well as Harry Kennedy from the Governor's Office. The A1 amendment will delete Section 2, which I'm convinced probably will set up standards that are unreasonable. And with Mr. Diebel's help as well, who helped draft this section originally, I think I'm comfortable that the standards are in place dealing with out-of-state sex offenders who moved to Minnesota having committed serious sex offenses in other states, that we have a process for assigning risk levels to them. Section line 1.3 on the amendment will just clarify that the disorderly conduct referenced in 609.72 in Section 3 does not apply to disrupting meetings. So Representative Lesch, Mr. Chair, the three times that you or I might disrupt a public meeting and be assigned a disorderly contact, we would not be classified as a sex offender after that third time. And then Section 4 moves mandatory training language to merely providing guidance to the Department of Corrections and Public Safety to take the training materials they currently have on predatory offending and targeting it more closely to communities such as child care providers, nursing home workers, group home providers, etc. Given the tight constraints and the desire to achieve the public policy goal without extending too many mandates, I think that this is a wise move.
Okay, and before we do questions on if there are any questions in the A1 amendment, just to clarify, on any of those public meeting disruptions, Representative Kalin, I was never convicted of any of those, which is the difference. Are there any questions of the A1 amendment? Hearing none, the Chair will move the A1 amendment. All in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. So the bill is in the order as desired by the author. To the entirety of the bill, Representative Kalin, did you want to go into that or just have your testifier proceed?
Mr. Chair and members, I think that probably it's best delivered by the expert here. So,
thank you. Then Deputy Chief Schlumblum, is it?
Schlumblum.
Schlumblum, please proceed.
Thank you, sir. The reason that I was asked today was to speak specifically about an issue that occurred in Chisago City, and this is a bill that directly addresses that situation. In 2005, we had registered offenders living in the city. In 2005, we actually had a large news program that came on through the local media saying that a local sex offender or an out-of-state sex offender was moving to our community. The person was going to be residing directly across from a daycare and within half a block of a primary school. The offender in this case had a conviction out of Nebraska. In that case, he was attempting to drag a young female off the streets and into his vehicle while she was rollerblading in her neighborhood with two friends. Fairly serious conviction. However, when the person moved into Chisago City, the state of Minnesota did receive his registration. He was registered properly. Law enforcement was notified. But because he was out of state, he was not given a risk level. So there's no way for us to say what his risk level would be, his tendency to reoffend. And most of our community notification laws and our data privacy surrounding this issue is set up around risk level. When a person comes in without a risk level, there's no way for us to say we can treat this person as a level 3 person given what they have, unless the state assigns a risk level. What we're looking for out of this legislation, I would hope, would be that when a person does come in from out of state, that they are reviewed by someone other than law enforcement. Currently, right now, we have the leeway to treat the person who comes in out of state as a level 2 offender. But that is entirely in the hands of the chief of police. It is not someone that does the review. It isn't your standard end-of-confinement review. And that's what typically takes place when a defender is released from prison. They are sent before an end-of-confinement review board, who then takes many, many factors and goes into in-depth to actually assign this person a level. The second part of this is also to provide a new offense of fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct, and we're looking for three offenses that would trigger that. The reason that is that, especially in this particular case, the offender that we dealt with in this case had numerous convictions, not charges, not arrests, but actual convictions for indecent exposure. There was clearly a pattern here, and it was something that was repeated over and over. There was no additional charges. You can have as many indecent exposures as you want. It doesn't aggregate. It doesn't get more serious. Each offense is treated on its own. And I think the bill is trying to address that by showing that we have a person who is making a predatory pattern out of his life. Goes around, seeks out people that he can, be they young females, be they older females, he seeks out people that he can victimize, and while not doing it with impunity, there is no increase. It's still a misdemeanor. It still has the same effect. It doesn't even trigger him being registered as a predatory offender. In this case, there's clear notes from the Ramsey County and St. Paul convictions that this offense he's convicted of, which was indecent exposure at that time, does not trigger registration. It doesn't rise to that level. It doesn't matter that he's done it two other times before that or however many times before that. It doesn't matter that he's got a prior conviction for dragging a girl off the street. This is a new offense. It's a decent exposure, and it does not trigger registration. In his particular case, because he was incarcerated and he was already registered, it did in fact lengthen his registration. But had he not been previously registered, there would not have been that consequence.
Other questions for Deputy Chief Slumholm, members? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Due to weather and other complications, a citizen leader who's been I would say wisely and sensitively working in the community to not only be vigilant regarding the specific individual, but trying to find a solution to this gap in our laws where you can continue to have multiple non-contact offenses and recidivate over and over and over and still be treated with something slightly more than a slap on the wrist, but not enough that actually gets you to treatment and gets you to a risk level assigned automatically, is Ann Tripler, who is the proprietor of Auntie Ann's Daycare in Chisago City, just, I think, two doors down from where Mr. Holmgren, the offender in this case, where he lives. And you should have the community impact statement that Ms. Tripler sent along with signatories from the community to Judge McBride for his sentencing. And I'd also like to read very quickly the statement of another community member who didn't want to be videotaped or named, but I think really goes to the point of the law, and I'll be brief here, Mr. Chair. She says, I would like to see some laws in place to prevent them, sex offenders, from living within a mile of the school, but I know that it's been shot down in the past. Not realistic, I guess. I would like to see tougher laws on people who continue to reoffend. Probation and 3 months behind bars is not a tough enough sentence for someone who was in prison for several years for an assault on a minor and continues to reoffend. Each offense since his release from his prison has escalated in his case, yet the sentence handed down to him was pretty minor. Will it take somebody getting abducted for the courts to take his Mr. Holmgren's action seriously? I would also like to see what we talked about at our meeting, a community information meeting that was held, not a notification meeting, but a community information meeting that was held with Department of Corrections in the community. Laws for licensed daycare, school district personnel, nursing home personnel, and other people responsible for vulnerable adults and children to go through training on what signs to look for if someone is being abused and where to take it from there. Also, how they can help families learn how to recognize the signs. I think that the legislation before you does do exactly what the community has asked for. I think it works to make Minnesota safer, not just make us feel safer, but actually make the state safer. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Representative Kaelin. Are there questions for members of the committee? Representative Lund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kaelin, I applaud your efforts. I think this is something that we all are concerned about. Just a question about the mandatory training. Is there currently some provision in law requiring training, or is it really up to the individual providers?
Representative Kaelin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lund, it's a good question. And as I understand it, having worked with the Department of Corrections and Public Safety, there's not currently mandatory training. I think the most compelling part of our community information meetings has been the training presented as an option by Lydia, and I believe Newland is her last name, but I could be butchering it, and I apologize, Lydia, but helping us communicate what the signs are to look for, and you know, there have been people who have been working in the field for 20 years who were at the meeting that came up afterward and said that was the most valuable part of the whole meeting, and it was their initiative that actually suggested it be mandatory, working with the department and with the Department of Health, or Human Services, excuse me, that does the licensing. We've agreed to just ask Lydia and the Department of Corrections to take the existing training and tweak it so you have very clear messages for child care providers, which would be different than clear messages for nursing home workers.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Representative Kaelin, so it sounds to me from what you're saying, if you could just confirm or clarify for me, that some of this information does exist. It's just a matter of perhaps packaging it a little bit different and providing it to, or tailoring it, if you will, to whatever the type of provider may be.
Representative Kaelin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, yes. Our hope is to do so with something that can be done within the existing resources of the department, knowing the tight budget year that we have.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions from members?
Chairman.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being a few minutes late. Representative Kaelin, I looked at the amendment that we just put on, and it looks to me as though, am I correct that this is sort of mandatory training for the department to create, but not necessarily mandatory training for providers to receive? If I read the amendment, it looked like the original bill, you were going to require providers to receive the training. Now it's the training has to be available, but you're not requiring them to receive it. Is that correct?
Representative Kaelin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cole, yes, I think supply side versus demand side might be.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Other questions from members? Seeing none, are there any members of the public who wish to testify on House File 551? Oh, Representative Paymar.
What's the motion? Where's the bill going to go?
The motion is to re-refer to Representative Hilstrom's committee.
And if I could make a quick comment, Mr. Chair and Chair Paymar. I've been working the Section 3, the 3 non-contact offense elevation section, actually came out of conversation and was suggested, volunteered initially by Bill DeNay from the Department of Corrections. and we're working hard to, we did not want to request the fiscal note until we had adopted the amendment, and we'll thus now be asking for the fiscal note, and I'd like to work with you. I think this is good public policy. I'm not one to just, you know, say that we should take extreme measures with sex offenders. We want to make actual increased safety, not increased threat. And so I'd like to work with you to figure out how we can get this public policy adopted, knowing that there are some fiscal implications.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. The chair will again move that the bill 551. As amended, thank you. That the House File 551, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Tamar, are you prepared?
Chair, I would move House File 248 and recommend that it pass and be referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee.
Okay, thank you, Representative Tamar. Please proceed on the bill.
Mr. Chair, this bill basically just amends section law authorizing the 4th Judicial District to establish a domestic fatality review team pilot project, so it would no longer be a pilot project, and it would allow other judicial districts to establish a domestic fatality review team if they so choose. It would also, on section 3 of the bill, requires that the that one report be submitted to the legislature rather than two reports each year. So that's basically some cleanup language in section 2 of the bill. And domestic fatality review teams are not a new thing. Hennepin County has done a great job with their fatality review team. But basically what it does is it looks, a number of different intervening agencies look at the facts when there's been a domestic violence homicide and tries to figure out what systematic problems have occurred that might get corrected in the future. So it's my hope that more judicial districts will start fatality review teams. This does not require that. There's no money involved here, but this will take the pilot provisions out of the domestic fatality review team in the 4th Judicial District. And with me is Deanna Anders, who is the Executive Director, Mr. Chair. If we might just have her give a couple minutes of historical background of the fatality review team.
Ms. Anders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate you considering House File 248. What this does, of course, is to maintain the existing access to not public data, which is essential to our work. We mostly draw from county attorney files, police files, medical records to create a thorough chronology of the cases as far back as we can. We look at the relationship, other involvement of police, all the way up to the homicide, as well as the court outcomes. As a result of our work, we've seen some significant changes, including the establishment of the domestic court calendar in the 4th District, the identification of strangulation as a lethality factor, which led to the passage of the felony enhancement for strangulation in 2005, and most recently a pilot project in the 5th Precinct of the Minneapolis Police that enhances investigation techniques and has led to a 23% increase in convictions of domestic homicide, or excuse me, domestic assault. The other piece of this bill
allows for other judicial districts in Minneapolis or in Minnesota to begin fatality review teams. The legislature outlined very clearly the scope of our data access as well as the scope of the teams, and so other judicial districts will be able to use that enabling legislation in the formation of their own teams. Thank you for consideration.
Sarah, you should also have another most recent report, the 2008 report in the packet, and you can see some of the work they do and some of the recommendations that they make and how they analyze individual cases.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Are there questions from members of the committee for Representative Paymar or Ms. Anders? Ms. Anders, well, or Representative Paymar, this was there's no cost associated with this, but how did the 4th District team get paid for previously?
Mr. Chair, we received funding from Hennepin County to fund a half-time position. It's our only staff position.
Thank you. And another question for Representative Paymar. The change of two reports to one, is that merely because this is a two-year deal and there was one report per year, now it's ongoing? Ms. Anders?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, are there any members of the public who would like to testify on House File 248? Hearing none, Representative Paymar will renew his motion that House File 248 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Representative Hillstrom's Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 720 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And you have testifier, I see.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is the Uniform Commission's recommendation on child witness testimony at, by alternative methods, and I would like to turn it over to Mr. Davis.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Davies. I'm here today as one of the Minnesota commissioners on uniform state laws. The use, what this act deals with is the use of audiovisual recordings to protect children in the court from fear, trauma, and intimidation. Minnesota was early into this field, and we come now to build on the successful experience we've had in Minnesota. Actually, Minnesota was one of the pathfinding states, and this is a typical problem we Minnesota commissioners have with our Minnesota situation. We're usually a little bit ahead of the, you guys are a little bit ahead of the game, and the Uniform Laws Commission is building on the Minnesota experience. So, but they go a little further in this one than Minnesota did, and appropriately so. The bill expands the coverage a bit. The original bill of Minnesota only applied to trials where the child was a victim of some criminal behavior, and this bill expands the coverage to a number of non-criminal proceedings. In any act, generally, there's an effort to balance the interests of the defendant, the child, the prosecutor, and the court. And the usual procedure was followed in the Uniform Laws Commission of a 2 or 3 year drafting effort. The there is some extension in the bill to a little older children from 9 or 11 up to 12. the bill deals with procedure, trying very carefully to have a proceeding where the court decides a yes or no whether it's going to permit the testimony by the child outside the courtroom using audiovisual materials. The bill lays down very carefully the standards of when this procedure will be handled, and then lays down some standards for what the order allowing the testimony by that means will how it will be done and so on. So that, but the order has to be very precisely done. And at this point, I think I'd just yield the question.
Are there questions for Mr. Davies or Representative Hillstrom? Seeing none. Any closing comments, Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair, I believe there is someone in the audience who would like to speak about this bill. I think that this has not been gone through by the Bar Association, and so I think they'd like to come to the table and talk to the committee.
Mr. Norton, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Glenn Norton. I'm the chairman of the Family Law Section Legislative Committee for the Minnesota State Bar Association. Our concern on legislation is always focused on family court and family law. I'm here to talk about this particular piece of legislation because we haven't looked at it. We don't know exactly how it will impact the family court. The family court is somewhat unique to other courts, other civil courts. This uniform procedure or provision would appear to address issues in civil court like tort court, housing court, various civil actions. But the family court is somewhat unique because sometimes, frequently, in issues of divorce, paternity, the children are the issue that we're arguing over. And so to make a procedure that is independent of what the family court has already set up in order to decide when and how we'll hear about what the children think about their own custody, which parent, and details like that, we haven't studied this. I was surprised to hear that it's a 2 or 3 year drafting effort, and no one's ever talked to us about this. And this is our focus area. My constituents are the people in family court, the people going through divorce, the people going through custody, the people arguing child support, and the attorneys that have to use this law to help those people. And I think we're an interested party on the thing, but we don't have a for or against position because we just don't know. We don't know whether it's going to cause extra hearings and extra time through the system. We don't know if it's going to cost our parties extra money because the attorneys have to go to another hearing, argue about a different thing than what's already the usual protocol. I would note in favor of such a proposal that I've practiced since 1986 doing family court. And I've been in 30 different counties in the state of Minnesota. They're all different. And sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's not. And when it comes to which kids testify and how they testify, if they testify, or if their information, what they think, comes in through a guardian ad litem or a social worker or a school counselor, that's something that right now the judges in the individual cases are deciding and figuring out. And I'm not sure that's bad. But if we're going to do something that's the same throughout the state, at least we'd like to review it as far as the family court goes. So that's what I have to say about this particular legislation. I guess we're not for or against it. It's just we're surprised by it.
Thank you, Mr. Norton. Are there questions for Mr. Norton from the committee? Representative Tamar?
Mr. Chair, if I might actually respond.
Representative Hillstrom.
First, I want to say that I commit to work with the Minnesota Bar on this situation. Again, this was brought to me. This is my first year carrying this bill. I just want the committee to know that this was, in fact, completed by the Uniform Law Commission in 2002, and it was approved by the American Bar Association. And the states that have already adopted it are Idaho, Nevada, and Oklahoma. And so it's my hope that between now and my committee that we can make certain that the Minnesota Bar is fully informed and we tweak whatever needs to be tweaked in this provision.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And also, Mr. Norton, this is a public process. Everything we do up here is on the record. And there are at least two other committees through which this bill must pass before it gets to the floor, so I think there will be ample opportunity to work with Representative Hillstrom and other members on the details of the language and be able to absorb it. So any other members or any other questions from other members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 720 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. I would move that House File 818 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
With that motion, please proceed, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Vulnerable Adults Bill, and this is a collaboration of, I believe, more than 50 organizations have been working on this. And so, Mr. Chair, I am just the person that they selected to carry it, and I would like to allow the people that have been working on this for a long time to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, and please have each testifier introduce him or herself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Hansen. I work with the Elder Care Rights Alliance as a victim advocate, and I'm a recent graduate from William Mitchell College of Law. We thank Representative Hillstrom for carrying this bill. It's very important to update the law as it exists now. The Vulnerable Adults Act first was written in 1980, substantially revised in 1995, and now we are proposing some more modifications to bring it up to date with current practices, technology, and trends. There are four main topical areas that the bill hits on. I'll leave the more specific to Mr. Carruthers, who will talk specifically with this committee's jurisdictional issues. The first topic that we talk about in the bill with several provisions is the financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. With more vulnerable adults and elders living in the community, we are seeing an increase in this area. And so to address that, we tweaked a couple of provisions of the law to fully protect vulnerable adults and encourage many people to report, such as financial institutions. The second area we talk about in our bill is when we have individuals who are missing, who have potential cognitive impairments, and how do we help find those individuals. Several states have enacted silver alert laws. Fortunately, Minnesota already has something of that nature, and we just add a few words to clarify and bring the law into focus with the current practices. The third area that our bill goes for is expediting the reporting system. Currently, there is a structure set up that provides for dual reporting by skilled nursing facilities, hospital swing beds, and boarding care homes, and our proposal will streamline that process to make the reporting more efficient to protect vulnerable adults and also work on centralizing a common entry point effective July 2010. The last area that our bill really looks at is social services and justice, as far as recognizing that from 1995, when the bill was very Vulnerable Adult Act, was very facility focused, and now we have members living in the community more frequently, how do we amend that functional definition to make sure that those cares and services in the home are being covered, as well as how investigation and education is conducted, consulting members of advocacy groups, ombudsmen, care providers, and the like. So,
Mr. Chair, with that, former Speaker of the House and former State Representative who held this, the seat I currently hold, will be our next testifier.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Mr. Carruthers.
My name is Phil Carruthers. I'm the Director of the Prosecution Division for the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I thank the author of this bill for carrying this bill. This is a very important bill. And I want to let you know that the prosecutors were very much involved in working on this and coming up with the language. And there were a number of us from Hennepin County Attorney's Office, the Attorney General's Office, the City of Minneapolis, the City Attorney's Office, St. Paul City Attorney's Office. And we feel it's really important to work on this. I came into this, and a number of us, through the area of elder abuse. But I want to stress that the elder abuse is just one aspect of crimes committed against vulnerable adults. But it's a huge problem because, of course, our population is growing older all the time. And I passed out a few statistics on this. I just want to highlight quickly a couple that emphasize the importance of this crime and that show the challenges that police and adult protection authorities and prosecutors face when we're trying to deal with crimes committed against the vulnerable and committed against the elderly. The overwhelming majority of elder abuse occurs in domestic settings. Most alleged perpetrators are adult children, spouses, partners, or other family members. Elder abuse is a severely underreported crime. It's estimated that only 16% of cases are ever reported. There may be at least 5 million elderly victims of financial abuse each year. And these are difficult cases to prosecute. Some of the challenges are diminished mental capacity and physical health issues of the victim, lack of victim cooperation, undue influence, and witness intimidation. It's a crime of isolation and control, often by family members of the vulnerable adult. It's hard frequently to get the financial records so that you can even investigate it. So you may have a suspicion, but if you can't get the financial records, you can't even pursue it. They're very hard to investigate, prosecute. They're complex cases. Some of the problems that we see as prosecutors are abuse of powers of attorney. These are broad powers that are given by a vulnerable adult to a person to manage their financial affairs, but sometimes they're blank checks. And so we see frequently, and we have prosecuted cases where family members basically loot the entire vulnerable person's estate, take the whole thing, sell the house, sell the farm, everything, and leave the person without the resources that they need to take care of themselves. We see access to checks because they are family members. Those checks are in the house. They know where to get them. Often joint accounts are set up. And when you have a joint account situation, again, these become difficult cases to prosecute. What this bill does, one thing it would do is make it easier to get financial records to adult protection authorities and to prosecutors and police. So sections 1, 2, 5, and 11 do that. By encouraging financial institutions to cooperate and give us the tools to get financial records, including through broadening the Administrative Subpoena Act, which is an important tool that prosecutors and police use to get records. Section 6 makes important changes to the law on financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult. There are quite a few provisions. This was put together and proposed by the Attorney General's Office. Their Medicaid Fraud Division has been involved in a number of these cases. And they have, based on their experience, found that we need to strengthen the statute. So one of the things it does is it creates essentially additional types of crime of financial exploitation, specifically using, managing, or taking the real or personal property or financial resources for the benefit of someone other than the vulnerable adult. That's frequently what happens. The person is on a joint account, and then they loot the money for themselves, not to be used for the vulnerable adult, but for themselves. Deprive the vulnerable adult of the benefit of their own financial resources. Or establishing a relationship, a fiduciary obligation type relationship by use of undue influence, harassment, arrest, compulsion, coercion, or enticement. We charged a case recently where a person with severe dementia was befriended by a waitress, and 2 weeks later
the vulnerable adult had given the waitress a power of attorney over the person's financial resources, and the waitress proceeded to loot over $100,000 out of the vulnerable adult's account and left them unable to take care of themselves. So that kind of situation is one that we're trying to avoid. Then we say that if the defendant knew that the vulnerable adult lacked capacity to consent, then consent is not a defense. So if you know the person doesn't have the capacity to make well-informed decisions, you can't say, well, they agreed to it. So we hope that that will strengthen our ability to prosecute these kinds of cases. And then a couple other things. In the theft laws, if there's a theft of more than $35,000, there's an increased penalty. It's up to a 20-year felony. This would make that same change as the financial exploitation crime. It would also allow us, to request a speedy trial when we have an elderly person or a vulnerable adult. And it would extend the statute of limitations from 3 years to 5 years for exploitation cases where the amount exploited is greater than $35,000. We have the same provision already in the theft law, so we'll make that same change in the financial exploitation law. And that, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, that's the provisions that we believe as prosecutors are very important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make it very clear that there are lots of other provisions of this bill, but I specifically asked the groups that were involved to focus on the things that would be within the jurisdiction of this committee. There are 52 agencies, entities, and organizations that have worked on this. More than 125 individuals have been involved in developing this 2009 proposal. 110 subcommittees divided into working groups on specific issues, from the reporting, the definitions, the protections, to bring the recommendations to stakeholder groups, and 323 individuals across Minnesota participated in 39 online surveys to gain broad input on the issue on the GAPS and Vulnerable Adults Act. So we've worked with the departments, we've worked with the ombudsman, we've worked with the stakeholder groups. This is quite a broad proposal, Mr. Chair, and I encourage members' support.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Colson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, for bringing the bill forward. I support and appreciate what you're doing here. I'm a co-author on the bill, and I'm looking forward to this moving forward. One of the questions, I know it's not really within the jurisdiction of this committee, but I had a bill in previous sessions. I believe Representative Holberg is carrying the bill this year. She's also a co-author on this bill. And it would help with some private enforcement, if you will, of some of these vulnerable adult issues by making some changes with regard to the ability of individuals to bring causes of action against guardians who are financially abusing the people they're to be watching out for. And I hope that you'll work with me on that. And whether I don't want to see anything get in the way of this compromise legislation happening, but if there's a way that we can help what Mr. Krebs is talking about on the prosecution side, and find some avenue to create some additional private enforcement as well, I think you might have an even better bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, just Mr. to draw Robinson. People's attention to Section 16 of our bill, we do create a private right of action for a vulnerable adult who has been financially exploited, and it's against anybody who has done the financial exploitation, which would include guardians, conservators, attorneys, in fact, anybody, private citizen, and it does allow for the reasonable recovery of attorney fees, guardian or conservator costs, or guardian ad litem costs, and treble damages, or $10,000, whichever is greater.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that, and I appreciate that. The situation that I'm familiar with that is becoming more and more frequent is one of several family members becomes appointed as a guardian, and that family member financially exploits the vulnerable adult, and the other family members are kind of left without any recourse. They don't have a private cause of action. They're not the vulnerable adult. They cannot pursue the guardian themselves. And so I think that I appreciate this is absolutely a step in the right direction. I'm sure there are some issues with I know Representative Mallory and others have had some concerns about the legislation that I carried 2 years ago. I look forward to continuing to work on those, but I think we need to be mindful not only of the vulnerable adult, but in some cases, while people can challenge the guardianship and the appointment, etc., I think there's some more we can do there.
Representative Hilstrom. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cole, I'll have the group of experts take a look at your proposal.
Representative Kass.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to see a little bit more under Section 12 about the common entry point designation. It looks like it's moving from each county board to the Commissioner of Human Services saying that there'll be one. Is that a statewide proposal then? So there'll just be one entry point for the entire state. How do we see that impacting some local control, or specifically people feeling as though that they can report this at a local level and have maybe a quicker response to this? I just want a little explanation on that.
Mr. Hanson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Kass. The goal with the statewide common entry point is a centralized system, whether it be online, fax, phone, however it works, to provide a more coordinated response or a coordinated intake process for these allegations of vulnerable adult maltreatment, whether it's incidents, maltreatment. And then as part of that system, it would preserve that local response, that immediate emergency response in the situations that deem such necessary, and also that intimacy of my mother's a social worker out in western Minnesota. She knows almost everybody in the town that she works with, so she can say, oh, this house is close to, you know, so-and-so, and this is the report. So it's an intake process that still keeps that intimacy, that emergency response on the local level without hopefully hindering it in any way. And we're working with the Department of Human Services and other agencies to make sure that in the development of this, that we don't lose that aspect of it.
Any other questions from members? Representative Hilstrom.
If I just might actually comment on that as well. Right now, you might not live in the same place that the vulnerable adult that you know of lives in. And so if you don't call the right place, you might not get the right help. And so this would establish kind of a 1-800 number that folks could call so that we could make sure that if you called someone that we got it to the right place.
Thank you. If there are no further questions from members, Representative Hilstrom would renew her motion that House File, I should ask, are there any members of the audience that are here who would like to testify on House File 818? Seeing none, then Representative Hilstrom would renew her motion that House File 818 be recommended of a pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight Division. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you, members.
There being no other business before the committee, I'll just note that our next committee meeting will be next Friday, March 6th. The notes on the agenda indicate 8:30, but that will not be the case.
Did you get the email?
Okay, so I believe the committee time will be 10:30. I can just confirm it on my handy-dandy iPhone here for a second. But I believe the time will be 10:30 on March 6th. And it's not working. So I'll get information to individual members about the meeting time a week from Friday. Meeting is adjourned.